Hello, everyone. I'm Luis, and this is The Debrief, a podcast from Incident.io. Today, incident management is a core part of organizations, both big and small. But what if you don't have an established incident management program? Where do you start? Or what if you already have a program, but you're looking to optimize it a bit? Where do you start in that case? Or another situation, what if you're an established organization with years of incident management experience? What are some things that you can do to really take things to the next level? To talk through all of these scenarios and more, I sat down with Jeff Ford, architect on the platform engineering team at Collectors. Jeff has been a part of organizations at each of these phases, playing a really key role in developing the incident management programs those organizations have today. So if you're looking for actionable advice on how to level up your incident management, regardless of which stage you're in, then you're going to really enjoy this episode. So here it is. Here's my conversation with Jeff. Jeff, well, thank you so much for joining us on The Debrief today. As always, I think it makes the most sense to just start with a quick intro. So could you tell us a bit more about yourself, particularly your experience running incidents?
Sure, absolutely. First of all, thank you so much, Luis, for having me. And thank you to Incident.io for letting me join today. My name is Jeff Ford, and currently I am an architect on the platform engineering team at Collectors. Collectors is the parent company of some pretty recognizable brands that you might know, such as PSA or PSAcard.com, Wada Games, and Golden Auctions. So we're in the collectibles market space. Over the course of my career, which is almost two decades long at this point, I have worked in a variety of capacities across production, high availability type environments in industries such as finance, healthcare, and other product-led startups. And in those roles, I have either been an individual contributor executing myself or leading initiatives as a manager or director in things that would kind of fall into the categories of DevOps or cyber reliability engineering or platform engineering today. Been doing those things a long time, automating operations out of the way, et cetera. So that's kind of career related. But outside of that, on my day-to-day in tech, I'm also a volunteer first responder. I've been doing that for most of my adult life. Yeah, and I'm also a certified fire instructor in the state of Connecticut. So I have a bit of experience managing all shapes and sizes of incidents.
I was going to say, you are both an incident responder and an incident responder. you are dealing with some very, very high stakes. I mean, not to sidetrack, but how is that? How is being a first responder, not in the incident capacity, but in the incident capacity?
It's something, I guess it kind of runs in my family. My father was is a volunteer first responder also. I've always just kind of been following him around doing it for a long time as I grew up as a child, and then kind of got into it myself. And I think I just have a passion for helping folks out. And sometimes it can be stressful, especially when it's a big incident or something very severe going on. But yeah, it's one step at a time.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I would love to ask, within the context of incident management,
sure,
what is something that organizations tend to get wrong with it? I know, yeah, a pretty broad question, but I can imagine, given your experience, you've probably seen a few things.
Yeah, definitely. It's a great question. And I think the thing I will anchor on there is, when implementing incident management or thinking about an incident management program, not having a clear idea of the why behind why you're doing it. And I think that that's in the forefront of my mind is something, a lot of organizations maybe forget. And I think there's a multitude of reasons why you would implement an incident management program or process. And those things vary from compliance to managing reliability or protecting customer experience, maybe even like quality. In some cases, like the fire service, life safety, right? But I think starting from a place where everyone involved in the process has an aligned vision of the why behind the reason for doing it is really necessary to kind of anchor on the outcomes and what you expect to get out of it. And that way you can kind of focus your implementation on the pieces of incident management that are going to help you achieve those outcomes.
And besides the why, is there anything else that organizations tend to like glance over or completely miss when it comes to incident management and response?
Yeah, I think another common misstep that I see is organizations viewing incident management as some weighty, heavy process that, you know, is more of a consumer of productivity than an add, like value add. And, you know, I really believe and view incident management as a vehicle which enables opportunities for the organization to learn, improve, and really enhance innovation over time. And yeah, I think to go back to my earlier point, it's you know, anchoring on those outcomes, what you hope to achieve. And maybe one of those might be to reduce the number or severity or length of incidents that occur in your organization. And figuring out like what enables that to happen. What's the thing that you're going to work toward to enable that outcome?
Yeah. And in your mind, like if you just had to guess, although I'm sure you have some ideas as to why, like why do you think organizations look at incident management as this like weighty thing that they kind of just like have to do instead of being very proactive about it? Because from the outside looking in, it seems like a very sensible thing, like, you know, downtime equals dollars and like you want to reduce that time as much as possible. So yeah, why do you think that organizations tend to approach it like with a very lax or dismissive attitude? I'm not sure if that's the right word, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I definitely know what you mean. And I think it comes down to, you know, trying to do it all at once. Thinking about like all the pieces of incident management, like when you implement an end-to-end program, like that feels pretty heavy, but you don't necessarily need to start at that size. You can start kind of more lightweight and evolve toward that.
So obviously we all make mistakes. It's part of work, part of learning, part of careers. But I'm really curious to hear, what are some mistakes you think you've made throughout your career when it comes to incident management? And how have those things informed how you approach incident management now?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm certainly no stranger to making mistakes in this area, both from kind of a individual contributor capacity, as well as, you know, someone trying to build and manage and lead an incident management program. I think something that comes to my mind is, you know, I started my career in financial technology at a very large enterprise that had a very mature incident management process. And I was introduced to carrying a pager very early on and what that meant and what expectations were around being on call and responding to incidents. And as I kind of moved through my career and went to different organizations, you know, places that were at different stages of their incident management journey, or maybe just starting out, I was somewhat rudely awakened to the fact that there's a varied understanding of what it means to be on call, especially in younger organizations where there might not be an established on-call program. And I think the thing that clued me into this was being a manager and in the top of the escalation path for an on-call and frequently getting paged and wondering, why is this keep coming to me? And then having the conversation with kind of the rest of the people on call and getting a very different view of what their expectations were for on call and what their understanding of the expectations of the role was. So I think that kind of goes back to, you know, as you're defining an incident management program, aligning on expectations, aligning on what the outcomes should be and what is necessary to achieve those outcomes.
This is probably very context dependent, but what ultimately determines how much organizations should be investing in incident management? Does it ultimately depend on like the stage that you're at, or is it something else?
Yeah, so I definitely think it varies. And how I look at it is really in the trade-offs that you're willing to make and the risks that you're willing to assume. For example, if we took and looked at an early stage startup, right? Focus of many early stage startups is on iterating quickly, finding the right product market fit, establishing their initial customer base. In that scenario, they're already making a lot of trade-offs, right, to deliver on those priorities and kind of get their vision off the ground. And in that stage, the investment and incident management probably doesn't need to be huge, and the basics will kind of get you through. So you're likely not going to have time to establish specific incident criteria or severity levels, and you might not or probably don't have the engineers to support a big on-call rotation. But I think the most important piece to establish in a small organization like that, or an early stage organization like that, is creating an environment where you can learn from your incident. And that doesn't have to be huge either, right? That can be something as simple as a post-incident review where, you know, you're focused on the lead up, the things that lead up to the incident happening, focused on what things helped mitigate the incident, what made it better, what reduced the impact, and then take those learnings and figure out what you need to follow up on to prevent it. And that really is all that's required at that stage. And I think the main takeaways from that is it establishes kind of that blameless culture early and develops a ground for learning and kind of continuous improvement.
What is your stance on blameless incident management? So I've heard so many arguments for and against. So on one hand, you have people who are saying blamelessness above all, we're not mentioning any names, we're going into this, everyone basically is anonymous. I'm putting this very simply, but basically everyone's remained anonymous. We're focused on the high level. And then on the opposite end, you have people who are saying, no, it's actually very helpful to name people, obviously very respectfully, but say, X person did this, and here's why. Here are the things that contributed to them making the change that resulted in an incident. So where do you stand on blameless incident management?
Yeah, you make some really good points there. And I would say I think it's a balance. Right. And I think it comes down to, at the end of the day, it's not about a person and a person like taking an action, right? But more about like, why was that action taken? Right. So in that case, like, even if you're naming names, like, it's still in my mind blameless, right? Like, we're finding out the reasons why that process occurred the way it did. And it's not the person's fault that they followed the process, right? It's more, what do we need to change? What are we learning about this process that caused a problem? And what do we need to change about the process to prevent that problem in the future? That's how I think about it.
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. So I'd love to talk about starting an incident management program. So if, and we'll talk about different phases here. So to start, I'd love to talk about sort of starting from the ground up. So from 0 to 1, then I'd love to talk about sort of from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 as a more mature organization. So starting out from the ground up, what would you focus on doing first when you were building out an incident management program?
Yeah, I think when starting from zero, or that initial step, or maybe like the example I gave in an early stage startup, is like establishing that culture around, you know, call it blameless if you want to call it blameless, but establishing that culture that enables learning, and that learning is the thing that you're prioritizing, figuring out like what happened, what the lead ups were, what you did to mitigate it, and then ultimately like what can we learn from the incident to prevent them in the future, prevent that type of thing from happening again.
And related to that, in those early days, are there any things that you should avoid doing?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I often got tripped up on implementing incident management is looking at, what other larger organizations are doing and seeing kind of a robust, complete process, in all its working, and then trying to implement that. And that leads to a kind of boiling the ocean effect where you're doing so much and trying to get it all right immediately. And the truth is you can't. So going back to my earlier point of figuring out what are the outcomes you want to achieve from implementing incident management, and then focus on the specific areas that will help you achieve that. Because if you go with the kind of boil the ocean approach, it can lead to a lot of adverse effects, right? Like things like responder burnout or fatigue. People don't see all the value of the different pieces up front. So they kind of question, why are we doing this? The process stops getting followed. I think that's a common thing that I myself have experienced. And, I think a lot of places that are trying to kind of go all in on incident management from the get-go kind of run into.
So let's say you've had an incident management program for a while now. So you're going, you know, you've done the 0 to 1, you have some processes in place, and now you're going from 1 to 2. What are the things that you can do to start to take that process to the next level?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things is kind of regularly looking inward on your process and holding retrospectives to gather feedback from those who kind of live in it day to day. So talking to your responders and asking what's working, what's not. Try to identify areas in the process that, you know, maybe the responders are frustrated with, or they feel that it's cumbersome or causing kind of fatigue or burnout. And then check in and make sure that the team is still aligned to the same outcomes that you have in your mind if you're the one kind of developing the process. And make sure that you have some measures in place to kind of track how you're performing against that those outcomes that you're desiring.
Yeah. In your mind, is there a cadence at which these retros should be happening? Or is it just, again, very context dependent, as a lot of this is?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is context specific. But, you know, I would say at a minimum, probably once a quarter is the right cadence, even when you're small, right? Especially when you're small, to check in and make sure that everyone is kind of aligned and is moving in the same direction, and that they're not kind of harboring any signals of frustration or kind of fatigue with the process. In more mature incident management programs, you might already have measures that you're looking at, things like your mean time to X type metrics, or, you know, maybe outstanding follow-up actions, or, you know, completeness of the post-mortem process or the debrief process. Those can be more regular and kind of real-time signals of when your process might be having trouble if you see numbers start to skew off in a direction.
That brings me to my next question. You mentioned like goal setting and metrics and things like that. Is it ever too early to start looking towards things like that? So for example, like we spoke about 0 to 1 a bit ago. Should you be aiming towards, you know, hitting certain numbers that early, or should you be waiting until you're slightly more mature, maybe in this sort of middle phase?
You know, I wouldn't anchor too heavily on the numbers ever, I think. And the reason I say that is like incidents are unpredictable, right? You can go through kind of a dry spell where there's not a lot, or you get easy ones that are easy to solve, or maybe they're things you've seen before. And then you can run into a spell where you're hitting new process breakdowns where, you know, you haven't seen it before. It takes a long time to resolve. So the numbers by themselves, I don't think tell the complete story. When I say like measuring kind of those goals of like over time, right? Like if you see trends in them, like if MTTX, you know, mean time to resolve or mean time to mitigation is consistently going up, right? Maybe that's a signal that, you know, there's not enough testing happening before something goes out in the environment. Or maybe it's a signal that, you know, there aren't enough runbooks to tell the folks who are on call, you know, how to operate this service or how to bring it back when there's trouble. But I'd say like point in time, that metric is probably not super useful on its own. So
what would you say to someone who is dead set on metrics above everything else? What are the risks that they're taking in doing so?
I think at that point, I would ask, what is the outcome they're hoping to achieve by measuring that metric? Yeah. Like, what are they hoping to change by kind of following that so closely? And then try to have a conversation around like, okay, are those metrics actually the thing that measures that outcome? Or is there something else that we're not measuring that we should be? And like what a better metric or a better way to track that outcome is.
Yeah, because again, like I can imagine it's very tempting, especially early on, to try to anchor yourself to these numbers that in many cases can be a misrepresentation of how things actually are and don't tell the like complete story or the narrative around why something may be trending in a certain direction versus another.
I agree with that. And I would say even one more is, you know, monitoring those things and kind of putting those metrics on a pedestal, if you will, right? And saying like, this is the golden signal that we're going to track can lead to other adverse effects, right? Like kind of gaming those metrics, like how fast can I close this incident so I get my mean time to resolution down? Like, okay, if you close it fast, did you actually achieve some learning from that? Or are we getting to a place where we can prevent that in the future? Maybe not. I think it's similar to when developers talk about code coverage, right? Code coverage is always a hot button topic of like, how much is too much? How much is enough? But it's another thing that if you put too much weight on it, it can become very easy to find ways to kind of game that number.
Yeah, for sure. If you're a more mature organization, so you've been doing this for a few years now, you know, 5, 10 years, what have you, what are some things that you can do to really take your incident management and response processes to the next level in this case?
Yeah, I think, you know, any organization that's kind of gotten the basics down and is now looking to go from, you know, 1 to 2 or 2 to 3 or 1 to 100, whatever it is, it comes back to like starting to look at your process inwardly and measure that process. So if you haven't already established, you know, a set of outcomes that you're trying to achieve, like that's the first step, right? That should be number one. But then putting some KPIs around, kind of going through having those retrospectives and identifying areas in the process that might be causing friction or fatigue or at the very worst, like burnout. All right, hopefully we're getting to it in a retrospective before it gets to that stage. But listening to that feedback and getting input from those responders on how they think best to address it, or like what are the things that would help reduce those areas of friction.
I'd love to sort of follow up on 2 points there. So first, goal setting, and then we can talk about fatigue.
Yeah.
When you're at this stage, again, I know this can vary quite a bit on so many factors. What goal should you be aiming towards at this stage? Let's keep metrics out of the conversation in this case, but like, yeah, what are some goals that you should be setting at this sort of more mature stage?
Yeah, I think things that I look at in a more mature incident management program is on the learnings front. Like, so we've talked about learnings a couple times and like, are we getting to those? But then are we following up on them? So, you know, incidents may have some immediate actions that you do during the incident, you know, when it comes to investigation or mitigation. And then once you get to the state of incident is mitigated or incident is even resolved, right? What happens next? And are we doing those pieces of the process, right? So did we hold the debrief meeting and kind of talk through with all parties involved what happened in this situation and what were the things that led up to it? What were the things that helped us mitigate it? Did we learn anything from that? And then oftentimes, most times, I would say that there's probably actions that you need to follow up on, things that didn't happen during the incident. Maybe it's a process change. Maybe it's adding documentation. Making sure that we're getting and prioritizing doing those things is an important part of the process. So if you're kind of going through the motions and kind of writing it all down, but we never get back to it, we're so deep in the weeds on other things, we never do something with those learnings. And like, is the process really effective?
Gotcha. And on alert fatigue, in your experience, what are some things that organizations can do to help prevent that? And I guess another question there is alert fatigue something that is exclusive to larger organizations, or is it something that can affect your team regardless of the size of your company?
Yeah, I think alert fatigue can definitely affect your organization regardless of the size. And I'd say even at, you know, smaller stages, like it might even be worse. And the reason for that is like figuring out what are the signals that are going to tell you when something is bad enough to take action. And I think that's, especially at a small organization, or I'll even say like some more legacy organizations that have kind of an older way of thinking about like systems alerting, might have a higher alert fatigue just because there's so many signals. So figuring out what are the things that tell you when something's bad enough to take the action. And what do I mean by that is really focusing on the experience you're trying to provide. And that could be, you know, if it's you know, website or software that you're providing, is like, what's the customer experience? What is the threshold at which a customer is going to get frustrated and decide to do something else with their time? And, you know, figuring out where you need to set the alerts to tell you that you're reaching that threshold and that you need to do something about it. it's kind of a conversation I've had a bunch of times across a multitude of organizations where, you know, maybe alerting is initially set up to tell you when a certain service or a certain process is using a lot of the CPU of a system or it's using a lot of memory. It's like, right, those aren't necessarily things that I care about. Like if the machine is working hard, that's fine. Let the machine work hard, right? If it's providing the right customer experience, I'm actually happy the machine is working hard, right? I'm getting the most value I can out of it. But if the machine is working really hard and the customer experience is really awful, like that's something I really care about and I want to know so that I can do something about it. Maybe I need to scale up. Maybe I need to rate limit or throttle or do something else. Those are the types of signals, like those customer experience-based signals, I feel, are the ones that you want to focus on surfacing on doing something about.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we touched on that, even if it were for a few seconds, because I think it's something that's really important and maybe something that organizations don't give much thought to until the problem is like metastasized into something really difficult to navigate.
Yeah. I would say like on that, like how to prevent alert fatigue, it's really coming back to when an alarm goes off, when a monitor goes off, when I get an alert, what do I do about it? Yeah. If the answer is nothing, or if I go look at it and then don't take some action to correct it, I probably don't need that alert, right? I'm only going to want to keep alerts that are telling me it's time to do something, right? Yeah. And then hopefully there's a runbook or hopefully there's something in place to tell you what to do. And if not, like that's probably a good time for an incident and then figure out what part of the process needs to change to prevent getting in that state or have a way to get out of that state.
Yeah. You've actually mentioned runbooks once or twice throughout this conversation. Is that another thing that is it worth creating one or some depending on the size that you're at, or is it something that's advisable regardless of the size of your organization?
Runbooks and documentation, they are hard subjects to tackle because I feel like there are things that we often don't prioritize as like kind of a definition of done or acceptance criteria as we're building something, especially in smaller organizations, right? Like we're trying to ship features, we're trying to get things into the hands of customers and then kind of move on to what the next thing our customers want is. I'd say at a minimum, it's a good idea to put runbooks or documentation of that sort into kind of definition of done for any new feature we're developing. Sure. Just so we have an idea of like what are the possible things that could go wrong? And then if there are processes that help get us out of those situations, they're written down so that, you know, maybe the person who's developing isn't the one who's on call that day. So sharing that knowledge or having a place to go find that knowledge is important.
Well, I'd love to sort of end on asking whether or not there's a ceiling on how good your incident management processes can be. And I will spoil the response to this question. I think the answer is no, there's never a ceiling. I think you can always make your processes better, regardless if you're talking about incident management or something else. But I'll let you answer the question.
Yeah, as far as the ceiling goes, no, I agree with you. I don't think there is a ceiling to how good you can make your incident management process. Incident management is something that should be able to adapt and evolve alongside your organization. I think the main thing is ensuring that you have an aligned vision of what outcomes you're trying to achieve with incident management and that you're kind of continually pushing in that direction. You know, thinking about, you know, is there a ceiling or not? It reminds me of a talk from Chris Gale, who is the VP of engineering at Yammer. And he's talking about this concept of diminishing returns. And he says something along the lines of something is much better than nothing most of the time, but perfect isn't much better than very good. And I think that's very applicable to developing process improvement for anything, let alone incident management.